I'm Renee Stubbs, and I'm obsessed with sports, especially tennis. Tune into my podcast each week to hear me and my friends in the community break down the latest matches, including the US Open. Plus, hear from some of the biggest names in the sport about what the future holds.
It's about belief, and once you break through that, right, then you know you can win a Grand Slam.
Listen to the Renee Stubbs Tennis Podcast every Monday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by Elf Beauty, founding partner of iHeart Women's Sports.
Hey, I'm Bruce Bazzi. On my podcast, Table for Two, we have unforgettable lunch after unforgettable lunch with the best guest you could possibly ask for. People like David Duchovny, Jeff Goldblum, and Kristen Wiig.
We're doing all the dessert.
We'll just skip right to it.
Our second season is airing right now, so you can catch up on our conversations that are intimate and often hilarious. Listen to Table for Two with Bruce Bazzi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. This week, I had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Andrew Huberman. Dr. Huberman is a neuroscientist and professor at Stanford University School of Medicine, known for his research on brain function, behavior, and neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to adapt and rewire itself.
The expectation on us is not perfection. It's being able to toggle between these different states.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
Marty Levingston doesn't claim he was an angel when he was younger.
We was running around doing stupid things. Like, we was running around doing street stuff. Just running around acting stupid, getting into fights.
He grew up on the streets, learning from other kids like him.
So, like, we caught ourselves wanting to be different little things, like different, or like trying to form. So I ain't know what the heck we was talking about. So
like a gang or like a music? Like what do you mean by form something?
Like, you know, like form something, like, you know, like we trying to like a clique.
Okay.
Like a clique, like, oh, we this, we that, like, but we trying to find, we boys, we brothers.
A group of friends having each other's back. Marty says he was never part of a gang or commit any serious crimes. He was a young dad getting his degree at the time that his life came crashing in on him. One day, he got a phone call from his mom.
I said, "Mother, what's going on?" She said, "Well, the U.S. Marshal's here."
Now, as I mentioned, Marty wasn't an angel. He admits that. He was familiar with the police. In fact, he had been accused of a shooting before, but that was cleared up. It hadn't been Marty. Normally, he wouldn't be too worried, but he says this time his gut told him something was off.
Really, on this one, it's like I felt something.
It was different.
Yeah. Like, this one is different. My name is Marty Levingston. I was wrongfully convicted for 15 years.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Marty Levingston. Marty Levingston was born on August 13, 1984, to Sandra and Marty D. Levingston in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Life was average.
You're an only child?
No, I got a, there's eight of us.
Whoa.
So my mama six, counting me. Then my father had two before then.
Wow.
So I got three brothers and three sisters. The oldest will be Talisha Evans, Daron Levingston, Darlene Levingston.
Marty is somewhere in the middle of all the siblings.
Then me.
Growing up, Marty says he was a daddy's boy.
My mom used to tell me stories about how she used to be trying to, like, feed me. Like, if she put something in her mouth and she tried to feed me with it, I smack it away. No. But she said, as soon as my daddy do it, I can eat it. I eat it. So my dad was just like, my dad would come get me when I was seven, eight years old, and I used to go everywhere with him. So,
but then Marty's parents split up and his dad moved out.
That's what shows me how powerful my mother is, because like she kept us with a roof over our head, kept food on the table. Like, you know what I'm saying? I don't know how she did it, but I used to sit back and watch her make miracles happen.
Not only did she make it happen, but Marty remembers lots of good times in his busy home full of love.
Sometimes it'll be out of kids. It'll be probably about, it could be a good 10 of us, 10, 11, 12 of us. Because if my cousin's over there, That's counting them too. So, so we fighting over cereal, boxes, cookies, video games. Like, it was just everybody, you know, they competing, fighting, arguing. But when you look back at it now, it was like, that was fun.
Marty says life was good. But then in 1996, when he was in his teens, his mom moved the family to the Hawaiian Terrace apartment complex in Mount Airy, a neighborhood in the outskirts of Cincinnati, which at the time was dealing with a lot of crime.
That's when I actually start, you know, picking up things, like, you know, learning things and...
Things like what?
The wrong things.
Marty says he started getting into trouble for things like selling drugs.
I start trying to find myself at that time. Like, you know, my father was away at the time. And so, like, I'm trying to find, you know...
Where was your dad at the time?
My dad was incarcerated.
What was he incarcerated for?
Well, he was incarcerated for, you know, at that time, well, he probably had some drug possessions or something.
How did that affect you?
When he left at that time, like, I was hurt. You know, I was hurt, and I'm trying to find myself, and it affected me. It affected me a lot.
Marty started learning how to be a man from the streets.
I was starting to get taught the wrong things at that time, like, you know, about just everything, about women, about life, mm-hmm. about everything. I was starting to get taught those things, like, you know, like, this how we should do it. This how we should look at women. This how we should look at people.
At 16, Marty had his first kid and went on to have three more. Marty says he was aimless and getting cues from all the wrong people. Back then, stories of neighborhood gangs were all over the local news.
Not a story you will see only on 5. You know, you used to only hear about gangs like the Crips and the
MS-13, Bloods, Crips, living and hanging out in areas you may least expect.
New information tonight on a local store busted for dealing drugs. Officers.
Marty says he wasn't part of any gang, but he was still involved with groups of kids and young men breaking the law.
I'm gonna tell you, like, I wasn't no angel. You know, it was I did live a lifestyle. And so you couldn't do that in that area. So they end up evicting my mother up out of there.
Marty left the neighborhood, but not the lifestyle. He says he kept acting foolish into his 20s and eventually made a name for himself with law enforcement.
I had run-ins, I had priors, I had juvenile record. Yes, I had priors. I was out there in the streets and moving around and stuff like that.
Though in between run-ins with the law, Marty spent part of his early 20s trying to get his degree.
I was going to job court. I was going there for business, business management.
What would you have wanted to do with business management? What were you thinking?
For real, I didn't know what I was doing. I look back now, I'm like, I shouldn't have went in there. I should have went and got carpentry or something. Mm-hmm. But so I'm like, I'm thinking business management because at that time, everybody that's from the streets, we saying business management.
Putting two and two together, business management and Marty's lifestyle, I can kind of guess where he was going with that degree.
So I'm going to Cincinnati Job Corps school at the time. And so my dad had called me and said, I just heard your name on the news. I say, for what? On the radio. They said he was looking for you for a shooting. I said, huh?
A shooting. This was Marty's first major arrest. It was in 2006.
That was for attempted murder, felonious assault.
Marty was arrested for a drive-by shooting at the University of Cincinnati. Two men had been injured. But Marty says he hadn't been involved, and the case against him didn't go very far.
The witness that got shot, he dated my little sister at the time. And so he even come in there like, yeah, I know who shot me. He ain't shoot me. He was up there. I seen him up there, but he ain't shoot me. And so that case ended up getting dismissed.
Still, Marty was on the police's radar, now more than ever. And not long after, Marty was arrested for another shooting. But this time, there was no survivor to say it wasn't Marty. On the evening of December 28th, 2007, two shooters opened fire at the Hawaiian Terrace apartment complex.
So do you remember when this happened?
Yes, I remember it like yesterday.
Tell me what you remember.
Well, what happened was, so I'm in a house. I'm on my mother's house. It's 3 days after Christmas. I got my daughter with me. So I'm in the house. I was actually laying down because I had a real bad migraine. I received a call by a friend of mine, named Andre. He called me and he said, "Brother, I heard a lot of gunshots out here." He go outside, he says, "Ambulance, fire trucks everywhere." I say, "Wow, what happened?" So he ended up asking somebody. They said, "What happened?" He said, "Man, somebody just got killed."
The victim was 19-year-old Michael Grace. According to reports, Grace had been living with his aunt at the Hawaiian Terrace apartment complex. Prosecutors said that the teenager had been trying to escape his former connections to a gang called the Taliban. But on December 28th, that former life caught up with him. Grace was in a car with his friend Carlos Mayo when members of a rival gang allegedly picked a fight with them, which ended in his fatal shooting.
So I just got up. I went in my mother's room and I said, "Mom, somebody just got killed in Hawaiian Village," because we called it Hawaiian Village too. I said, "Well, Mom, you know they will try to put that on me."
Remember, Marty used to live at Hawaiian Terrace before his family was evicted. He was connected there.
She said, "Well, you weren't out there. You was right here."
But Marty knew his relationship with the streets and the police would work against him.
My name always came up when something happened, even when I wasn't even being in that area no more. My name still came up.
Why did you think they were going to try and put it on you?
Anytime something happened, they either go question me or pull me over or do something like that. So I knew that area. I knew either they go try to put this on me, they go come question me, they go do something.
But they didn't. At least not until after the new year, when a witness named Savannah Sorrells appeared.
So she was a young woman who lived in the area, lived in a position where she could see the shooting from a window in her house.
This is Donald Castor.
I'm an attorney and a professor of clinical law at the Ohio Innocence Project at the University of Cincinnati, and I was privileged to be one of Marty's attorneys in his post-conviction proceedings.
Donald says that Sorrells told police she saw Marty and his co-defendant, David Johnson, kill Michael Grace.
And when they showed her a picture of Marty and of David, she said to each that was them. So Marty and David were charged.
Once in custody, Marty tried to tell the police that he'd been home with his mom and daughter the night of the shooting, that they were making a mistake, just like last time. Except this time, friends and relatives of Michael Grace were pointing the finger.
Now I have a whole neighborhood saying that they thinking that I killed their cousin, brother, or friend, whoever. And so that's what made that one different.
And this time, detectives had Robert Taylor, a jailhouse informant.
Robert would come forward to the lead investigator on Marty's case and say that he heard Marty and David talking about the case through the air ducts in the Hamilton County Justice Center.
That's the jail Marty and his co-defendant David Johnson were being held in. Robert Taylor claimed that through the air ducts, he'd heard Marty admit that he'd killed Grace, that they were members of rival gangs, and they were fighting over stolen guns before the shooting. Marty says Taylor was known in the jail as a snake.
They called him White Chocolate. Watch him. He a snitch. He jumping on people's cases. He doing this and doing that.
So Marty stayed away from him, but it didn't matter.
I end up getting a visit from my attorney, and he basically was telling me who they was using against me on my case. And he showed me a picture of him, said, "Do you know this guy?" I said, "That's the jailhouse snitch that be running around in here." He's like, "Well, yeah, they want to use him as a witness on your case."
Police had an informant making serious accusations. But over the following months, the rest of their case against Marty seemed to fall apart. At a pretrial hearing, Savannah Sorrells, a key witness, changed her statement.
Savannah came into court and said, "You know, I said it was Marty, but I didn't actually see Marty." She said, "I saw David."
Remember, David was Marty's co-defendant.
"And I knew that David and Marty hung around together a lot. So I assumed that it was Marty with him. But I didn't actually see who was with David. I could just see that there was somebody with David." And she said that, you know, at under oath in a pretrial court proceeding.
And Carlos Mayo, the person who was with Michael Grace during the shootout, told the authorities that Marty hadn't been there the night of December 28th.
When he testified, he said he was firing at my co-defendant. And they asked him, like, "Okay, do you know Marty? He said, "Well, I know him enough to identify him. If I If he was there, I would have seen him. I would have knew he was there. But no, I ain't knew of him until they put him on the news.
This sounds so crazy to me. I feel like there's more people saying he wasn't there than he was there.
There was nobody who said he was there besides Robert Taylor.
Right.
The snitch.
Right. The snitch, who turns out was getting a pretty sweet deal for testifying.
He offered testimony to support the police because he was facing a murder charge. It was the first major offense he had been charged with. It's pretty clear he was scared and didn't want to get convicted. And in fact, he got a monster plea deal from the prosecution in that case, was allowed to plead to involuntary manslaughter and only did a few years in prison.
To testify against Marty
and others. But Marty was sort of the, Marty and David was sort of the big case.
Wow.
That got him that deal.
But with the pretrial testimony of Sorrells and Mayo in his favor, Marty thought surely the charges against him would be dismissed. But then the judge set a trial date.
I'm like, a trial date? Like, I mean, I really about to take me a trial on this? I got a whole witness getting up here saying that I ain't commit this crime.
Even though it might seem really weak to take to trial,
there was a lot of pressure to get this case solved and resolved, because at the time there was an increase, or at least a perceived increase, in gun violence in Cincinnati. There was a lot of impetus to put somebody away for this crime.
Amid this climate, with fear of violence and constant stories of gangs in the nightly news, Marty went to trial in January of 2009, prosecuted by Gus Leone and Anne Flanagan.
How do you feel about biscuits? Hi, I'm Akila Hughes, and I'm so excited about my new podcast, Rebel Spirit, where I head back to my hometown in Kentucky and try to convince my high school to change their racist mascot, the Rebels, into something everyone in the South loves, the biscuits.
I was a lady rebel. Like, what does that even mean?
I mean, the Boone County Rebels will stay the Boone County Rebels, but the image of
it's right here in black and white in print. They lying.
An individual that came to the school saying that God sent him to talk to me about the mascot switch is a leader. You choose hills that you want to die on.
Why would we want to be the losing team? I just take all the other stuff out of
home. Segregation academies, when civil rights said that we need to integrate public schools, these charter schools were exempt from that.
Bigger than a flag or mascot.
You have to be ready for serious backlash.
Listen to Rebel Spirit on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Katie Couric. If you follow me on social media, you know I love to cook, or at least try, especially alongside some of my favorite chefs and foodies, like Benny Blanco, Jake Cohen, Lighty Hoik, Allison Roman, and of course, Ina Garten and Martha Stewart. So I started a free newsletter called Good Tastes that comes out every Thursday, and it's serving up recipes that will make your mouth water. Think a candied bacon Bloody Mary, tacos with cabbage slaw, curry cauliflower with almonds and mint, and cherry slab pie with vanilla ice cream to top it all off. I mean, yum, I'm getting hungry. But if you're not sold yet, we also have kitchen tips like a foolproof way to grill the perfect burger and must-have products like the best cast iron skillet to feel like a chef in your own kitchen. All you need to do is sign up at katiecouric.com/goodtaste. That's KATIECOURIC.com/goodtaste. I promise your taste buds will be happy you did.
Señora Sex Ed is not your mommy's sex talk. This show is La Plática like you've never heard it before. We're breaking the stigma and silence around sex and sexuality in Latinx communities.
This podcast is an intergenerational conversation between Latinas from Gen X to Gen Z. We're covering everything from body image to representation in film and television. We even interview iconic Latinas like Puerto Rican actress Ana Ortiz.
I felt in control of my own physical body and my own self. I was on birth control. I had sort of had my first sexual experience.
If you're in your señora era or know someone who is, then this is the show for you.
We're your hosts, Diosa and Mala, and you might recognize us from our flagship podcast, Locatora Radio.
We're so excited for you to hear our brand new podcast, Señora Sex Ed.
Listen to Señora Sex Ed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So Tell me about trial. So in my notes, I actually don't have any kind of defense, really. Did that actually happen? Was there no defense?
Well, I'm trying to remember. Did Hal put your family on as an alibi?
Marty's defense attorney in 2009 was Hal Arenstein.
No.
Okay, yeah.
I talked to Hal about that, and he was like, putting your family up there, they go, okay, you put your moms up there. They go, your mama lie for you. You put your this and that. But when I look back now, I'm like, I should have put my mama up there.
So
like,
who went up there for you?
Nobody.
No one. There was no defense presented. And that was a pretty common defense perception that juries don't believe alibis from family members.
Sure. But how is he supposed to get a defense without a defense?
So I think the idea, and let me be very clear about this. Hal is a really good attorney.
Beautiful attorney.
I take no issues with anything that Hal did in this case. I think the idea, though, was that this case was just so weak from the prosecution's point of view that no jury would convict. And I think that if this case were tried today on that evidence, juries are skeptical enough that they wouldn't. But in 2008, before there was a little bit of the more sophistication that juries seem to have now, and when people in that time were afraid of the perception of increasing gun violence, Marty was convicted.
Sentenced to 31 years to life for murder, felonious assault, and tampering with evidence.
When they said guilty, I said, how? What did I? I look back, my mom said, we appeal it. And I'm like, wow. So it ain't kick in right away. Because I still ain't know the law. I never been to prison before. So I ain't know how nothing was. I ain't know how the process is with these appeals and stuff like that. I just ain't know nothing. I was lost in the whole situation.
Shortly after his conviction, while he was still trying to process everything, Marty says his grandma sent him a passage from the Bible.
Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. She sent me that scripture and she said, baby, she told me, you ain't gonna be able to do that without God.
So Marty says he continued reading the Bible and started going to church.
I need some hope. I needed some faith. I needed some peace.
And he started to reckon with the life he led before prison.
I'm locked up for something I ain't do. But why I'm locked up? So I had to start looking at that. Something led up to this. And that's when it got to showing my lifestyle. The lifestyle I was living led up to this. Because if I wasn't in the streets, if I wasn't running around, I ain't saying that don't happen to them, that happened to people like that. But if I wasn't running the streets, my name wouldn't have never came up in that at all.
So Marty says he decided he was going to change.
So I'm like, let me get me together. Let me learn how to be a father. So I start taking classes on dad and I and, fatherhood classes on how to be a father or, even how to be a husband or how to be a brother, how to be those and what do it really mean? Because I was taught wrong. I stayed focused and, I became facilitators of programs in there.
What kinds of programs?
We had a program called Real Man where you got guys talking to the youth that's coming in. You got guys coming there 18 years old. So I'm doing things like that through the chat Pacer, Real Man programs, Family First. I was consistent and I worked out, exercised a lot, went in the law library, just read a lot of stuff like that. And it changed me.
Marty put in a ton of work on himself and his case. For years, he appealed his case on issues like suggestive witness identification, because police had shown Sorrells only one photograph instead of a lineup to confirm Marty as the shooter. Plus, another witness had come forward, claiming that she'd seen the shooting and Marty hadn't been involved. Also, Marty wanted DNA testing on the shell casings found at the scene, but all his appeals were denied. So Marty wrote the Ohio Innocence Project, and he waited.
So one day I'm sitting up in the bed. It was 2012. And so he said, well, Levis, do you have a visit? So I'm like, damn, I wonder who this is. I ain't got no visit set up. I don't know if somebody was coming to visit me. So I'm thinking, oh, that must be somebody important. So I went ahead and hurried up, put my stuff on.
When Marty got to the visiting room, it was Donald.
And so I come in there. He got a Mr. Donald, he got a look on his face. Mr. Donald got a serious look on his face. I'm coming in here like, hold on. I know he wasn't playing no games. So I'm like, he come in there, he talking to me. I tell him what's going on. He said, give me a few days and I'm going to talk to somebody. I ain't telling you it's a go yet, but I'm going to talk to somebody and just call me Monday and see what's up. So I went back praying, but I called my mama like, Innocent Project can't see me. I don't think the guy liked me.
But meanwhile, Donald couldn't wait to get started.
I came back to the office and I started telling everybody that I got this innocent guy, Marty Levingston, and we got to get him out. And
so Donald and the Ohio Innocence Project set to work on Marty's case. For years, they tried to find new evidence to get Marty back in court. Then their break came in 2021 because of developments in what's known as touch DNA testing. Donald and his team applied for post-conviction testing on all the evidence that hadn't been analyzed for prints and DNA during the original investigation. They were appealing to the same judge that had denied Marty's previous appeal. But this time, the judge wanted to have a hearing to find out what evidence existed that could prove Marty's innocence.
And she said, maybe I'll grant it, but I want to have the hearing and I want to make the state tell us what evidence exists that could be tested.
But that never happened. Before any DNA testing could materialize, prosecutors went back to Marty with a new deal.
And at that point, the prosecution was willing to offer what's called this dark plea deal.
So the key to understanding what a dark plea is when it's offered, okay?
This is Justice Michael Donnelly.
I presently serve as an associate justice on the Ohio Supreme Court, where I've served since 2019.
Justice Donnelly is an expert and a vocal critic of what he calls dark pleas, which are deals prosecutors make behind closed doors with people who claim they've been wrongfully convicted, who are looking for a new trial, like Marty.
When you're on the front lines of the system and you see the injustice that occurs as a result of a non-transparent system and people being coerced into plea bargains that should not, I think it's an obligation on all judges to speak up.
But he didn't always have dreams of advocating for justice and practicing law. He actually wanted to be a musician.
So the music career didn't work out the way I expected, but I've been able to incorporate my love of music into my life.
In his mid-40s, he started a band.
We're called Faith and Whiskey, and our motto is, if you don't have one, you better have the other. We do a lot of benefits, including the legal aid benefit here in Cleveland, which is legal event of the summer. I call it the Jam for Justice.
So you find being a rocker at night, Supreme Court judge by day, they work well together.
They do. Well, my kids think it's cool.
Justice Donnelly says he used law school as a delay tactic to get his music career off the ground. But next thing he knew, he was an assistant county prosecutor.
And then went into civil litigation, practiced a total of 12 years before taking the bench as a trial court judge.
Justice Donnelly was a trial court judge for 14 years.
So I'm fully aware through my observations of during those 14 years of the coercive nature of plea bargaining as it exists in the modern day.
Pleas or deals where the defense, prosecution, and judge come to an agreement on a conviction and sentencing instead of at trial.
And very early on in my career, and what I describe as one of the biggest epiphanies of my career, I began to question the ethics of what takes place in that back room.
He says judges have outsized power when it comes to backroom negotiations.
There's no objective criteria that judges use to accept or reject a plea bargain. Like sometimes you might be in a judge's backroom chambers and that you've come to an agreed sentence with the prosecution and the defense. And the judge might say, I don't agree with that. I think this person has to do 5 or 10 or whatever. And this gets said in the back room and the question is never raised You know, what guides the judge to do that?
Now, when it comes to people like Marty, people who have been convicted but claim they're innocent, Justice Donnelly says the deck is even further stacked against them.
It is very difficult to have the court system look at your case for a second time and reconsider it.
And judges can take their time deciding on a post-conviction case.
And judges sometimes let those motions languish for years. Right. There's no speedy trial or the equivalent of speedy trial rights for innocence claimants.
In Marty's case, it took several rounds before a judge even agreed to allow DNA testing, which could have opened the doors for a brand new trial. But before Marty got a second chance at proving his innocence, the prosecution approached him with a new deal, the dark plea.
Señora Sex Ed is not your mommy's sex talk. This show is La Plática like you've never heard it before. We're breaking the stigma and silence around sex and sexuality in Latinx communities.
This podcast is an intergenerational conversation between Latinas from Gen X to Gen Z. We're covering everything from body image to representation in film and television. We even interview iconic Latinas like Puerto Rican actress Ana Ortiz.
I felt in control of my own physical body and my own self. I was on birth control. I had sort of had my first sexual experience.
If you're in your señora era or know someone who is, then this is the show for you.
We're your hosts, Diosa and Mala, and you might recognize us from our flagship podcast, Locatora Radio.
We're so excited for you to hear our brand new podcast, Señora Sex Ed.
Listen to Señora Sex Ed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
How do you feel about biscuits? Hi, I'm Akilah Hughes, and I'm so excited about my new podcast, Rebel Spirit, where I head back to my hometown in Kentucky and try to convince my high school to change their racist mascot, the Rebels, into something everyone in the South loves, the biscuits.
I was a lady rebel. Like, what does that even mean?
I mean, the Boone County Rebels will stay the Boone County Rebels, but the image of...
It's right here in black and white in print, so they lying.
An individual that came to the school saying that God sent him to talk to me about the mascot switch is a leader. You choose hills that you want to die on.
Why would we want to be the losing team? I just take all the other stuff out of it.
Segregation academies, when civil rights said that we need to integrate public schools, these charter schools were exempt from that.
Bigger than a flag or mascot.
You have to be ready for serious backlash.
Listen to Rebel Spirit on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you ever wonder where your favorite foods come from?
Like, what's the history behind bacon-wrapped hot dogs?
Hi, I'm Eva Longoria.
Hi, I'm Maite Gomez-Rejon.
Our podcast, Hungry for History, is back.
Season two.
Are we recording? Are we good?
Oh, we push record, right?
Okay.
And this season, we're taking an even bigger bite
out of the most delicious food and its history.
Saying that the most popular cocktail is the margarita, followed by the mojito from Cuba and the piña colada from Puerto Rico. All of these.
We thank Latin culture.
There's a mention of blood sausage in Homer's Odyssey that dates back to the 9th century B.C.
B.C.? I didn't realize how old the hot dog was. Listen to Hungry for History as part of the My Cultura podcast network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's Marty's attorney, Donald Castor, again.
So what they said is, look, we will support a motion for a new trial. And the basis for the motion in the new trial is just going to be, we, the prosecutors, believe that Marty was over-sentenced. In exchange, we will expect Marty to plead guilty to involuntary manslaughter. He will be immediately eligible for release, and the case will be behind him. And it's a tough thing.
Well, what was the option if you didn't take that?
To keep fighting over the DNA evidence. And even if everything fell perfectly into place, it would be another at least couple years of litigation before we got a new trial order, at least.
Donald says Marty had a tough choice to make.
Marty was getting anxious. His parents were getting older.
Yes.
He wanted to see them again. His kids are growing up without him.
Justice Donnelly says this is the crux of the dark plea.
Do you want to take the risk of what's behind door number three? You want to take the risk? You can do that. Or here's the keys to your jail cell. Which one are you going to take? That's exactly mm-hmm. what's happening. So I've never criticized anyone for taking the dark plea because it's so unconscionable.
So even though Marty would have to forego the opportunity to prove his innocence, he decided to take the plea.
You know what? I'm gonna go ahead and take it. I know I'm gonna probably be on parole, and I'm just gonna get out and prove him wrong and show him wrong. Like, nah, I was not that.
So you took it.
Yeah, I took it.
On February 16th, 2023, Marty stood in front of Judge Wendy Cross.
So, are you nervous?
I'm nervous. I'm heart beating. And that's when she said it's a good day. The judge said it. Judge Cross said it's a good day. And she said everything that she, you know. And she said, you will be going home to your family. Then I just looked up. Like, what?
Did anyone, like, did you hear anything? Was there a gasp or a scream or
anything?
Oh,
yeah, yeah. The family, yeah, they had to quiet down. Yes, they, yes, you heard, I heard them. It was different than when they said guilty. Guilty, it was crying and screaming. This time it was joy.
Dark pleas are a really bittersweet moment for everyone. In fact, when Marty went home finally, I think what Judge Cross said exactly was, yes. It's always a good day when justice was done. And that was hard for me to hear because I was sitting in the room, and while I was very happy that Marty was going home, it didn't feel to me like justice was happening that day.
That bittersweet feeling is one Justice Donnelly shares, which is why he's made it his mission to stop the practice of dark pleas.
This is the way power works. In the dark.
If it were up to him, the judge in Marty's case wouldn't have allowed for a backroom deal with the prosecutors. She would have held a hearing out in the open, let Marty's lawyers prove his case, and make the prosecution stand by theirs.
Because when a hearing takes place in open court where the press can attend and observe, you see the merits or the lack of merits rise or fall to that standard that the innocence advocates are trying to get. Hey, the theory of guilt that was told to the original jury has been completely undermined. And then it becomes clear to the judge, you have to put the defendant or a new trial or not.
As far as in his own courtroom, Justice Donnelly decided long ago to put all backroom conversations on the record.
That way, everybody's held accountable. The prosecutor, the defense lawyer, and me, the judge.
Justice Donnelly actually coined the phrase dark plea because he says if you can name it, you can fix it.
If this term were to become commonplace and saying, and you could say, judge, they want to offer me a dark plea, and the judge could say, no, we're not letting that happen.
Marty was released in February of last year into the arms of his loved ones. And since getting out, Marty has wasted no time catching up on life.
Everything been great. You know, when I first came home, you know, I got married 2 months later to my wife, Latoya Levinston.
That they are husband and wife. Amen. And
we got married April the 8th. And since then, it's just been... It been, cause I'm learning now. So we kind of bump heads a lot because I'm still learning. She been out here, so it.
What's one of the hardest things you're learning?
Patience, like being patient with things, like being in line for something, or
you know, I don't just have patience for that either.
Even,
trust me.
Even like you know, just even dealing with finances and stuff. It's just different little things that I have to learn.
What's it like being back with your kids? I mean, some of them you really didn't even see them grow up.
I'm starting to learn how important I am and my responsibilities as a man in the house, you know, because you got to think I'm coming inside a house with some children that don't know me, ain't grew up with me. So like they got to learn my space. I got to learn their space. I got to learn what to say, not
to say.
And
they're adults. It's not like they're kids. You know what I'm
saying? They like, they learning me too.
Marty works as a stationary steam engineer and has a clothing line with his cousin called Extravagant Culture Department. And he's been attending speaking engagements with Justice Donnelly and Donald at the OIP, the Ohio Innocence Project, to advocate against wrongful convictions and dark pleas. Marty not only considers them colleagues, but family.
OIP been with me all the way through.
Yeah.
You know, like, just even, like, if I'm going through something, I could call him for anything. Like, I mean, I call him all during the day. Like, I call Mr. Donald. Text him, call him. I call anybody from down there. And they go pick up to me. And it's not fake. If I need to see him, I still go down to the office all the time down in the college. I think I come in there more than anybody, don't I?
You may be there more than I am.
Yes. So I always go down there and check on everybody. And it's my family, so.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organization. You can go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help and to read more about Justice Donnelly's work on dark pleas. This episode was written by me, Maggie Freeling, with story editing and mixing by senior producer Rebecca Ibarra. Our producer is Kathleen Fink, our researcher is Shelby Sorrells, with additional mixing by Josh Allen and additional production help by Jeff Clyburn and Connor Hall. Executive producers are Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wordis. The music is by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Make sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good podcast in association with Signal Company Number One.
Hey, I'm Bruce Bazzi. On my podcast, Table for Two, we have unforgettable lunch after unforgettable lunch with the best guest you could possibly ask for. People like David Duchovny, Jeff Goldblum, and Kristen Wiig.
We're doing all the dessert.
We'll just skip right to it.
Our second season is airing right now, so you can catch up on our conversations that are intimate and often hilarious. Listen to Table for Two with Bruce Bazzi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Renee Stubbs, and I'm obsessed with sports, especially tennis. Tune in to my podcast each week to hear me and my friends in the community break down the latest matches, including the US Open. Plus, hear from some of the biggest names in the sport about what the future holds.
It's about belief, and once you break through that, right, then you know you can win a Grand Slam.
Listen to the Renee Stubbs Tennis Podcast every Monday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by Elf Beauty, founding partner of iHeart Women's Sports.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. This week, I had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Andrew Huberman. Dr. Huberman is a neuroscientist and professor at Stanford University School of Medicine, known for his research on brain function, behavior, and neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to adapt and rewire itself.
The expectation on us is not perfection. It's being able to toggle between these different states.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.